Greetings and a happy new year to all my excellent listeners. Welcome to this January 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for the never controversial science podcast, Jim Campanella. It seems that some issues will simply not be put to rest. And so it is with my story from a couple of months ago involving American science majors. Even after last month's response, I have continued to get emails telling me that I'm still in the wrong and did not go far enough with my comments. Among the most vocal, and certainly the most thoughtful, of these emails came from listener Greg Granger. And I have to admit that Greg pointed out a blind spot that I did simply smooth over last month. And his point was this. Sometimes science and math teachers really are horrible and make your academic lives hell. Here's a quote from Greg. Quote, I have a BS major in computer science, and I switched from math to computer science after I began. It was a very difficult decision for me. Part of the reason was that in one class I asked the professor to explain the transition between two steps in a proof, and his answer was, you just know. In context, this would be like asking you how you know that DNA contains an adenine thymine base pair, and getting the answer, you just know. In a different math class, I was confused when I received only partial credit for the proof I provided in an exam. I compared my answer with a classmate and noticed the answers were almost identical. But unlike me, he received full credit. After class, I asked the professor about this difference, and he told me that he knew my classmate understood, but he wasn't sure I did. I was attracted to math because I thought it was objective, but found that not only was it subjective based on my experience, but further, it was quite possibly based on the unexplainable. Unquote. I feel for you, Greg. You are correct that I should have spoken about the teachers out there who stink and are unmotivated. I was so focused on those factors having nothing to do with the teachers that I lost sight of the fact that a lousy teacher can completely screw up your academic career. And I am sorry that you did not have the best of experiences. Most of us have had experiences just like you. One of my physics professors in college, a very famous British scientist who was one of the men responsible for inventing the electron microscope, told us, the students, the very first day of class, that he hated teaching and preferred to be in the laboratory than a classroom. He was sure that we hated being there as much as he did and insisted that we would just have to put up with each other the rest of the semester. That is not the way to motivate students to love science. And equally, if a professor grades unfairly in math or any other subject, or gives less than helpful answers to sincere questions, then they are just discouraging any academic growth you may have. One of my older colleagues, now gone from teaching, used to actually grade exams based on how much they liked your answer, to the point where they would actually give negative points and take off more credit than a question was worth if they felt your answer especially terrible. You could hypothetically get a negative grade on an exam out of 100. At the same time, this professor gave extra credit if they liked an answer. Now that is blatantly unfair. Another professor that I know of now, and students rightly despise, locks the door to the classroom when they begin a lecture. You may be 10 seconds late, but they will not let you into the classroom. That is a blatantly horrendous and unfair offense against someone who wants to learn and has paid for that privilege. I can go on and on, but I will agree with you. I should not have been so defensive about faculty. I think part of it was that I think the bad teachers are the minority, not the majority. So I too quickly dismiss people who insist that the teachers are the problem. I should have agreed that teachers are part of the problem, but still, only part. Greg and several other listeners also made this point. I completely forgot to point out that simply by sheer population numbers, Asia has already surpassed the U.S. by 700 million people. All things being equal, India and China should have about 2 to 3 times more gifted people in any particular area than the U.S. Those who point that out are absolutely correct. I should have discussed it. Simply by sheer numbers, Asia will surpass the U.S. very soon in terms of talented and trained scientists as China and India open more and more universities. At the same time, if you look at graduate schools in the United States, that scenario may already be the case. Most doctoral students in the United States are now already from Asia, not from the U.S. I would guess that at least 50%, if not more, are from Asia. And many will go back to Asia once they are trained to teach at newly opened Asian universities. It used to be that those trained scientists stayed here. That is often no longer the case. Hence, another reason the U.S. is losing scientists. Okay, I really hope this is the last time that we need to discuss this. 3 months with this same theme recurring has been a bit too much for my taste. Please, no more emails on the topic. I will not talk about it anymore if you don't. Thank you. Let's talk about some real science now. The first story of the night involves sharks. And something about sharks that came as a surprising fact to me that I had never heard of before. It is very common among closely related species that share common niches to mate, hence producing fertile hybrids. Except in plants, that was thought to be fairly rare at one time in animals. However, genetic evidence has suggested that animal hybridization is actually quite common. Even human genetic evolution, as we have discussed previously, shows evidence of human Neanderthal hybrids. Along with some colleagues, I've been doing population genetic studies on bluegills at a big lake in New Jersey here, and we have often come across hybrid individuals between bluegills and a sister sunfish called a pumpkin seed, and you can tell by the coloration and body morphology which are hybrids. So I supposed that it was a fairly common thing for fish species to hybridize. I was a bit surprised to learn that until recently, in the last couple of weeks, no shark hybrids had ever been found. Dr. Jess Morgan and collaborators from James Cook University in Australia discovered the first hybrid shark off the waters of Australia and published their results in the journal Conservation Genetics in December. Morgan says, quote, "The mating of the local Australian blacktip shark with its global counterpart, the common blacktip, was an unprecedented discovery with implications for the entire shark world." Unquote. Her find was made during classification work off Australia's coast, where they performed genetic tests that showed certain sharks to be one species, even though they physically look like another. The Australian blacktip is slightly smaller than its common cousin and can live only in tropical waters, but its hybrid offspring have been found 2,000 kilometers down the coast in much colder seas. Morgan says that this could mean that the Australian blacktip could be adapting to ensure its survival as sea temperatures change because of global warming. It took me a while to kind of figure out the implications of this, but I think it's this. The original parental species could only live where the water was warm and tropical, whereas the hybrid could live where the water is cooler, and so can take up niches farther south where it is colder and where the parental species can't go. Hence, the hybrids can expand their ranges massively into the cooler water and not even compete with their parents. It turns out the hybrids are more vigorous in colder water and warmer waters than their counterparts. And if the waters of the oceans continue to increase in temperature, the hybrid may be able to compete in both the temperate and tropical niches way better than their purebred parental species, and hence may be able to survive and reproduce much better. The hybrids were extraordinarily abundant, accounting for up to 20% of the blacktip shark populations in some areas, Morgan said. In short, ladies and gentlemen, we are seeing microevolution taking place here. We are seeing selection of an organism that can best survive a particular environment and reproduce. For those who are still wavering in whether evolution actually exists or not, this is a nice object lesson. The next story has to do with what some people term fringe genetic experiments, but frankly, what were fringe experiments even a few years ago are now becoming much more mainstream. Before I tell you about this story, I want to make clear my views on the use of embryonic stem cells in research. And no, I'm not going to go into any kind of a religious or anti-religious or political or even moral or ethical tirade. I am going to simply stick to the science facts. For those of you who do not remember, embryonic stem cells are tissues taken from an embryo during development. Yes, the embryo has to die for the tissues to be harvested. These cells have a limited ability under laboratory conditions to develop into various tissues that can be used therapeutically. For years, ignorant politicians and the consistently foolish out in Hollywood have screamed that embryonic stem cells are the answer to a million human maladies, including most famously paralysis, a la Christopher Reeves. There's only one problem with this. Embryonic stem cells have never, never in all the years of research cured anyone or shown any promise in curing anyone. You are welcome to look at the scientific literature yourself. Government science agencies continue to throw good money after bad in embryonic stem cell research, despite the growing evidence that it is the wrong line of endeavor. Why? Because it is a political football that has nothing to do with whether the work is accomplishing any real science or not. Am I saying abandon stem cell work? No, because adult stem cell research is making headway, and treatments with adult stem cells have actually cured dozens of human ailments. Adult stem cell research has shown over and over again that cells need to develop so that the inborn genetic controls are in place. By working with differentiated cells, you have much tighter control over the activity of the cells. Put simply, why are we wasting our time, money, and effort on something that is quite plainly dangerous? Yes, it is dangerous. Embryonic stem cells are dangerous because they are untamed biologically. Those cells have not undergone enough of the long developmental process to be under any kind of control. And frankly, one has to be nuts to inject cells that may develop into just about any tissues into a patient. In 2009, the United States FDA allowed clinical embryonic stem cell trials to progress. The company, Geron, was allowed to test the stem cells on 10 patients with severe spinal cord injuries. Most of the treated were unaffected by the embryonic stem cells. And when I say unaffected, I mean nothing was cured. They were the lucky ones. The unlucky one was a boy in the trial who ended up with spinal and brain tumors resulting from stem cell therapy. Not only was it difficult to predict how exactly the cells would differentiate, but stem cells have a tendency to divide. They are very much like cancer cells that way. The injected fetal cells were expected to divide, hopefully to create new neural tissues, but the scientists had no way of knowing for certain where the division would lead or how much division there would be. Well, now they know. So now that you know my views on the subject, here is the actual science story. The paper was published in the January 5th issue of the journal Cell. The work was done by Dr. Shukrat Mitalipov of the Oregon Health and Science University and his colleagues. And what did they do? Well, they created monkeys that had six different parents. I can hear the wheels turning out there as you think about this. Wait, what did you say? Six? Six parents? How is that possible? Well, these rhesus monkeys are what are called genetic chimera. If you remember your Greek myths, the chimera was a monster made up of a bunch of different animals thrown together. These monkeys did not come about by any normal sexual process. They carry six different sets of genetic information in them from six separate parents. There were two questions that the paper examined. First, how far can you push cloning using embryonic stem cells from primates? And second, can you make primate chimeras? In mice, when embryonic stem cells are injected into a blastocyst, the resulting animal is a chimera containing cells from both the original blastocyst and the injected cells. Now, a blastocyst is a ball of cells. The outer part becomes the placenta and the other supporting tissues, while the embryonic stem cells inside give rise to the actual fetus. In new experiments, the researchers found that both embryonic stem cells grown in the lab and fresh ones could not incorporate themselves into a developing primate fetus. The paper states, quote, "This work may show that the embryonic stem cells that we now have are not quite as potent as we think," unquote. So to answer the second question, to create the chimeric primates, the researchers had to take a step backwards from the blastocyst stage to embryos at the four-cell stage of development, when they could not get the embryonic stem cells to incorporate into the embryos. The researchers created the chimeric monkeys by fusing six of the four-cell stage embryos together. They named the three monkeys Chimero, Roku, which is Japanese for six, and Hex, which is Greek for six. They report these genetic chimera are all normal and healthy, and I can tell you from the photos that I saw in the journal article that they look absolutely normal. No extra limbs, no extra heads. Because rhesus monkey stem cells behave so much like human embryonic stem cells, researchers think that the findings can be extrapolated to human cells. That means that they are beginning to suspect that embryonic stem cells are not as powerful as they once thought. Since no one had ever made a chimeric primate before using stem cells, the evidence that human and monkey cells are able to blossom into any type of cell has been mostly circumstantial. Well, now, with this failure of making chimeras from embryonic stem cells, it appears that all that circumstantial evidence was probably just speculation. The researchers who did this work are now looking at other primate embryos to see if the limitation they saw in the rhesus monkeys is something species-specific. In other words, if it's only a problem with rhesus monkeys and you don't see it in other primates. It should be interesting to see what happens. The next story may be a little late for those of you who over-imbibed on New Year's Eve, but at least for you Americans out there, this may help after Super Bowl Sunday, if you get totally inebriated. An article that came out this month in the Journal of Neuroscience, written by Dr. Jing Liang of the University of California, Los Angeles, suggests that a kind of new hangover cure may be on the horizon. I say kind of new because this cure is based on Asian folk medicine that has been around for more than 1,000 years. Liang says that an extract isolated from the seeds of the Asian tree Hovenia dulcis was first described as an extraordinary hangover remedy in the year 659 AD. In the new study, Liang and her team tested one ingredient of Hovenia called dihydromyrisetin, DHM for short. They tested this on rats who are affected by alcohol just like humans are. After rats were given the equivalent of 15 to 20 beers in a very short time, the animals passed out and lost the ability to flip over when placed on their backs. The rats took about an hour after this bender to regain control of their bodies and flip back over. Now, this sounds like something out of James Bond, like an anti-alcohol pill, but when the rats received a concentrated shot of DHM along with their alcohol, they tolerated the booze better. They still lost the ability to flip themselves over, but the stupor took longer to take hold, and it only lasted about 15 minutes. As far as hangovers are concerned, DHM also benefits beyond the period of drunken stupor as well. A dose of the compound helped ease rat hangover symptoms 2 days after an alcohol binge by curbing anxiety and susceptibility to seizures. Now here's the most amazing bit. DHM seemed to curb alcohol consumption in the rats. Untreated rats allowed to drink alcohol gradually started consuming more of it. However, rats that drank DHM-laced alcohol did not increase their consumption, the paper found. This may be overstating the case just a bit, but Liang says, quote, when you drink alcohol with DHM, you never become addicted, unquote. Another author of the paper was not quite as optimistic as Liang about the breakthrough. He said, quote, though these results are exciting, they don't mean that a shot of Hovenia extract can enable you to have a night of consequence-free binge drinking. Alcohol has many effects on the brain, and DHM may not block all of them, unquote. So far, Liang and her team have found no side effects from DHM. The researchers now plan to test DHM's effect on people. If you are desperate to try Hovenia on your next bender, or after your next bender, I suggest you find your nearest Chinese herbalist. You will not be able to get pure DHM for injection, obviously, but I suspect that the herbalist will have dried plants right up there on the shelf next to the ginseng. My pronunciation is probably horrid, but the plant is called Zhijuzi in Chinese. That's Zhijuzi. This next story frankly leaves me seething because I truly get upset by scientific abuses. For years you have been told that red wine is good for your heart and can help keep you young. And you have been told by nitwits like me that compounds in wine like resveratrol can help lengthen your life and improve your cardio fitness. Well, it turns out this is all untrue. How do I know? It seems that the scientist who discovered this and published it allegedly made it all up. Dr. Dipka K. Das, University of Connecticut researcher, who studied the link between aging and resveratrol, has committed more than 100 acts of data fabrication and falsification, the university said a couple of weeks ago, throwing much of his work into doubt. Das directed the university's Cardiovascular Research Center and published in 2007 that, quote, "the pulp of grapes is as heart-healthy as the skin, even though the antioxidant properties differ," unquote. The university said an anonymous tip led to an investigation that began in 2008. A 60,000-page report resulted from that tip. The report outlines 145 counts of fabrication and falsification of data. Other members of Das's laboratory may have been involved. The university doesn't know, and they're being investigated, the report continues. The University of Connecticut has declined $890,000 in federal grants that were awarded to Dr. Das, according to the statement that they published in Reuters. They have begun dismissal proceedings against the good doctor. Additionally, the university has alerted 11 journals that published Das's work, and it has worked on the case with the U.S. Office of Research Integrity, which investigates alleged misconduct by federal grant recipients. Remember that if you take federal monies and then make up data, that is fraud. Federal fraud. Dr. Das is in a lot of trouble. The journals that got bilked include the journal Antioxidants and Redox Signaling, where Das was one of the editors-in-chief, and the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. I want to finish up this science news with an update on the exoplanet search. Well, the astronomers said that it was simply a matter of time, and they were right. And apparently the time has finally come. They have finally found planets that are Earth-sized. The newest exoplanets found by the Kepler Space Telescope's Industrious Eye are two rocky, Earth-like planets hovering around the star Kepler-20. Which is about 950 light-years away. The two planets have been dubbed Kepler-20e and Kepler-20f. Dr. David Charbonneau of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics wrote the paper along with his team, and it was published in late December in the journal Nature. These are the first Earth-sized worlds confirmed by the Kepler team, but they are still not quite what the astronomers have been looking for. The astronomers' ultimate goal is to find habitable worlds that are not too distant from Earth across galactic space and which are Earth-sized planets and at the right distance from their stars to allow the presence of liquid water. They have not yet found an Earth twin. The paper reports that Kepler-20f could have an atmosphere, but suggested that extremely hot conditions on Kepler-20e would have evaporated any atmosphere. Kepler-20e is a bit smaller than Venus, about 87% as wide as the Earth, and completes a trip around the star every 6 days or so. The other, Kepler-20f, is about 1.03 times as wide as the Earth, and a year on that planet lasts about 19 days. Because the planets are so small, they're probably made of the same rocky ingredients as the Earth. The paper also stated that, quote, "depending on where and how it formed, Kepler-20f could even have developed a water atmosphere if it started out with the amount of water we had on Earth and Venus." It's probably long gone, though. I guess the actual makeup of the planetary system of Kepler-20 is very weird, too, which accounts for why the Earth-sized planets are not in the life zone. The Kepler-20 system is comprised of three large planets, Kepler-20b, c, and d, and then two Earth-sized ones, all tucked in nearer to their star than Mercury is to the Sun. Moving out from Kepler-20, the five spheres alternate in size, with the smallest of the planetary litter bracketed on either side by their bigger brothers and sisters. The weird part is that all those planets are stuck in there in an orbit so close to their star. That is a first from what the paper suggests. Charbonneau calls the system a, quote, "shock architecture," unquote, which will be a nightmare for astronomers to explain. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Make sure you take your Hovenia shots before your next pub crawl, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.